Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to History Rage, the podcast where historians like to casually sentence their favourite myths to a botched execution. And welcome to another one of our live specials from the Gloucester History Festival, coming to you from the beautiful setting of Blackfriars Priory. I am your regular host, Paul Bavel, and bringing the heart and stomach of a king to our podcast today, I am happy to introduce Oxford Professor of History and author of From Tudor to Stuart, Susan Doran. Susan, welcome to History Rage.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm looking forward to this.
You are welcome. Are you feeling angry?
Not really, no.
Okay, well, we'll get you there. We'll get you there. So before we dive into your chosen rage today, then, I wonder if you would just take an opportunity, because this is the first time that we've met. It's only my second time at the History Festival. You could tell me about your books and your career, how you came to write your latest work, and what it's covering.
Yes, well, I've spent my career on the Tudors. So this is a new venture for me, going past the 1603 line. And my most well-known book is Elizabeth I and Her Circle, which is about Elizabeth's relationships with the counsellors, the courtiers, the women around her, and looks at a mixture of personal and policy in the reign of Elizabeth when we're talking about national politics.
Yeah.
Before that, I wrote a book that I suppose made my name, which was called Monarchy and Matrimony. And it was investigating why Elizabeth did not marry. And it took a rather different view from most other books in that I didn't see her as being determined from the very start to be the Virgin Queen.
Ooh, rebel thoughts.
And look more closely at the kinds of inhibitors for her marrying and the opposition to the particular candidates that she had her eye on or who had their eye on her.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and you mentioned here that this is a departure for you going past the 1603, getting out of that Elizabethan and Tudor age and into the dark and murky world of Stuarts. What's prompted that?
I think there are two things. Number one is that I wanted to be doing something fresh.
Mm-hmm.
I felt as if I went back and continued to work on Elizabeth and the Tudors, that somehow it might be a bit stale for me. I knew the material pretty well, and I had to find something sparkling to attract me back into the archives and work on it, which I hadn't yet found.
Yeah.
So the challenge of doing something new and James was the person and the subject that I chose because I'd actually encountered him a great deal in the work I'd done on Elizabeth.
Yeah.
And I'd done a lot of work on the succession to Elizabeth. Who was going to be the successor? What were the problems the successor had? And in a sense, because I love stories, this was, well, what happened next moment?
Yeah.
And I decided that's what I wanted to do. I wasn't quite sure of the format, and that always develops as I go on. Originally, I thought I'd just do a few years, possibly, of how James managed to get on the throne, but then I wanted to see how he managed. And in the end, I chose the first decade of his reign, in part because in 1612, two important men died. One was Prince Henry, his son, his eldest son, which I felt left an emotional vacuum for James. And the second was Sir Robert Cecil, who by then was Earl of Salisbury.
Yeah.
And who in some ways marked the bridge between Elizabethan and Stuart England. And I think left a political vacuum. Mm. And as I argue in the book, that the world after 1612 is pretty different from the way it was before.
Well, I look forward to reading it.
I
really do.
In that paper.
Weighty tome there. So it's the sort of thing that you can throw at your husband in an argument. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well then. Okay. So we're here at History Rage. We know what History Rage is about. So let's light that blue touch paper. So first of all, would you tell our baying mob out there, what is the one thing you wish everyone would just stop believing?
I wish they would stop believing that Elizabeth was spiteful and jealous of both her cousins and her ladies-in-waiting. Even respectable historians use the phrase or the word spiteful in relation to Elizabeth. And I dislike it for two reasons. One is it's misogynistic. I've never heard a man being called spiteful. And the second is, I don't think it's true. And it doesn't allow us to think about why does Elizabeth behave the way she does.
Yeah. Okay, so before we dive into that detail then, first of all, cousins' relationships I understand. That one I get. However, ladies-in-waiting, I am not a medievalist or a Tudorist by any stretch of the imagination, or in fact have much crossover with the royals. So could you outline to us just really what a lady-in-waiting does, and particularly why kind of highborn noble women would become what a lot of people view as a servant?
Yes. Well, of course, they don't use the phrase ladies-in-waiting. They talk about ladies of the bedchamber.
Yeah.
And they talk about gentlewomen of the privy chamber. And they talk about maids of honour. Maids of honour are the young women. And why they want, they're not mean, well, they are menial in a way. I mean, yes, sorry, they are menial. But they don't see it as menial. And they don't see it as menial because it's an honour to serve the Queen. It's an honour to be close to royalty. There's that kind of charisma. And also because it's politically valuable to their families. If they have access to the Queen, they might also have the ear of the Queen and can whisper into it as some requests of members of their family. And they are also on display. They are attendant on the Queen on important occasions. They might pick up a good husband on the way.
Yeah, or a bad one.
Or a bad one, indeed. Some do. And in addition to that, there are lots of goodies that can be acquired. And because it's known to be a job, menial or not, or a position, menial or not, that is for women of noble or very high gentry class, then there is no sense of it being something that's beneath their dignity.
Yeah. And what sort of duties do they have? I mean, you talk there of a lady of the bedchamber, the lady of the privy chamber, the maid of honour. What sort of things are these people doing?
Well, sometimes they're just a backdrop for Elizabeth. When she appears, she rarely appears on her own. There are women who are behind her and to the side of her, providing her with, as I say, the kind of wallpaper backdrop that she needs in order to show her her magnificence. But in the private apartments, they will be carrying out tasks such as getting her meals on the table and making sure one of them at least will make sure that she's not being poisoned by tasting her meals first. They will entertain her. They will make sure that there are stories that they can tell her, gossip, that they sit around and do embroidery together. They look after her clothes and her jewels. There's one of the women is in charge of all her jewels, obviously the most trusted of all. So there's jobs they do, but they're not heavy, menial jobs by any means.
Yeah, they're no maid of all work, are they?
No, indeed. And they get, they don't get a proper salary. They get some, but it barely covers their costs because they have obviously high costs in terms of their appearance and providing themselves with the kind of accoutrements that they need to appear as very cultured women.
Yeah, well, they may be not exactly getting a salary and not meeting their costs. They are all coming from particularly wealthy backgrounds already, aren't they? They can finance this job.
Absolutely, yes. And their families are very, very keen to have their daughters there in the royal household. And it's something that is an honour and also can be politically useful.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm thinking correctly, and I hate to bang on about, you know, particularly because Nina's just raged at me that there are other women in history than the six wives, but as I understand, Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour, and Catherine Howard were all ladies-in-waiting to one of their predecessors,
exactly.
If not more, yeah.
Yes, exactly. That's right.
So that's the level of promotion that the families can get by...
Well, not in the case of Elizabeth, of course, but yes, you're absolutely right, yeah. That what they can do is, at best, is pick up a husband that Elizabeth will approve of and where there will be wedding gifts and other ways that Elizabeth will show her favour.
Okay, so we're going to start off by focusing on spiteful relationships then. So I'm going to pluck two out here, which is Mary, Queen of Scots, the cousin, and the Grey sisters, then the ladies in waiting. So what can you tell us about these relationships? How much of this is political? How much is personal? What's really going on there?
Well, one thing we have to admit is that there is a limit to our knowledge about personal relationships. We can't look into the heart of Elizabeth and find out whether she liked or disliked on personal grounds, either Catherine or Mary Grey, the two sisters who are treated by our terms very badly by Elizabeth.
Yeah.
So what happens to them is that they marry without the Queen's permission. They don't tell the Queen even after the marriage. And when the Queen finds out, she separates them from their husbands. In the case of Catherine Grey, she declares it, well, she doesn't, but her archbishop and her commission declares the children are bastards, and she forbids them from ever, well, they're in under house arrest for a long time, and their husbands are too. And in the case of Catherine Grey, he had to pay a heavy fine. So why does Elizabeth do it? Well, it's often said it's that she was feeling spiteful because these women could marry and that she couldn't. They could enjoy romantic love and she couldn't. Well, I suppose the timing of Catherine Grey does allow for one to think that, because it's when Elizabeth has had to say no to Robert Dudley, who later becomes Earl of Leicester, because of political circumstances, means she can't marry him. And I think it's true that she probably did want to marry him. But that is not the reason why Catherine Grey gets such a raw deal. There are a number of others. The first is that this woman betrayed her. She was in Elizabeth's house guard. Elizabeth was acting in loco parentis. And she only admitted to the marriage after she was pregnant. And it was clear she was about ready to drop her oldest child any day. And then she speaks to, not to Elizabeth directly, she speaks to Robert Dudley. So she goes by a circuitous route to reach Elizabeth, to try and get Elizabeth to treat her kindly. That Elizabeth was never going to do, leaving aside even other political factors, and there were others, because it's disobedience. And the same goes for Mary Grey, and we can come to her in a minute. But the political factor was that Elizabeth in the 60s is trying to do a deal with Mary Queen of Scots.
Yeah.
Mary Queen of Scots wants to be named to Elizabeth. And if Elizabeth shows favour to Catherine Grey, and if Elizabeth recognises Catherine Grey's children, then there's going to be trouble brewing north of the border. And I think that is an extremely important reason why Catherine is treated badly. Why she's in prison for so long is because some of her supporters who did want her to be the next heir to Elizabeth and her son to be recognized as legitimate and become, after Catherine, the next heir, they support her and they start a pamphlet campaign in her support. And that really is the last straw as far as Elizabeth is concerned, especially as Mary Queen of Scots is getting very edgy about this. So there are political reasons. There's a sense of honour and what is expected of a woman who is going to be in Elizabeth's household.
Yeah, and I suppose if you're in the royal household, that is a position of trust. And if you breach that trust, you haven't got that position and you shouldn't hold that position.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. I mean, it's Elizabeth is, after all, mistress and queen. It's kind of double roles. And it's just been treated with a total lack of respect here. And that matters in 16th century society.
Yeah. Their reputation is everything.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, so a couple of other of Elizabeth's ladies-in-waiting then, Blanche Parry and Catherine Ashley. These play important political diplomatic roles during her reign. So how does Elizabeth cultivate relationships with those women? And to what extent does she rely on their counsel and support? And how does she treat them?
Okay, well, the first thing is, both Blanche Parry and Cat Ashley were her servants from childhood. Mm-hmm. They're not someone she appoints when she becomes queen. And they have to follow the rules of the game. Otherwise, they get into trouble. Why does she give them so much affection? It's because they looked after her as a child. They looked after her too when she was in danger during Mary's reign. They have demonstrated their maternal feelings towards her as well as their loyalty to her. And so they can't cross the boundaries. And what do I mean by that? They can't, for example, tell her who to marry. They can't get involved in any kind of negotiations that might influence who she will marry. And when Cat Ashley does that, she gets wrapped over the knuckles. So if these women know their place and they do what Elizabeth wants, she might confide in them if she really trusts them. But there's always a line that they can never be true confidants. They can never be true friends. There's always, you know, that not just the hierarchy, but also the sense of Elizabeth knowing that she's got to be safe.
Yeah.
And you can't tell anybody really what's in your inmost thoughts because it can leak out. And Elizabeth is very well aware of that. Because what happened to her when she was living in Catherine Parr's house? Do you know what happened to her?
It was Nicola Tallis's talk last night that opened my eyes to that one, but that's absolutely horrifying.
And of course, Cat Ashley.
While I know, my listeners don't. So do you want to fill us in on that?
Okay. Well, what happened was that there was a suspicion that Edward's uncle, Thomas Seymour, who was married to Catherine Parr, was planning, once Catherine Parr died, because she was much older, or perhaps even before she died, to have an affair with Elizabeth and marry her. And there were rumours that they were having some kind of sexual hanky-panky. How far it went, nobody quite knew. Mm-hmm. But the point from what we're talking about today is that Cat Ashley was interrogated and gave some really quite detailed information to the council about how Seymour would come into Elizabeth's bedroom and sort of bounce her up and down on the bed. Now that
And she's what, 13, 14
she's 13,
at this time?
Absolutely. Elizabeth, what was happening was probably grotesque. And I don't think there was a sexual relationship there, but I think what Thomas Seymour was doing was putting down a marker so that if Catherine Parr did die in childbirth, then, you know, Elizabeth would be, as it were, next in line, and that she would have already had a sense of a relationship with him that might develop into something more. But what was really important from this point of view is that Cat Ashley had, I think, to, you know, you could say she was threatened with all sorts of things, I don't know, but she betrayed Elizabeth by giving out this information, and she was never punished by Elizabeth. I don't know if Elizabeth realised just how much Cat actually had revealed, but she clearly knew that she had been interrogated and that Elizabeth thereafter was in some trouble. So despite that, there was no spite that she displayed.
There is a case there that, I mean, I only found out about this last night, so I haven't had a lot of time to run this over, but is there a case there that she betrayed Elizabeth, or is it a case there that she rescued Elizabeth, or is it both?
I don't think she rescued Elizabeth.
You wouldn't view her as a whistleblower?
No, I wouldn't, because the whistle had already been blown because Thomasina had already been arrested on other counts. So Elizabeth could have been kept out of it. I mean, obviously, other people were whispering around as well. But I don't think there was a rescue involved. I don't quite understand why she gave away as much as she did. It's a bit of a mystery still.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So historians have noted that Elizabeth carefully manages rivalries, tensions. She's always portrayed as politics is always going on in the Tudor court. So, and that's amongst her female courtiers as much as her male courtiers. So what can you tell us about these rivalries and how Elizabeth actually maintains control amongst all this without kind of heavy-handed spite?
Well, can I just switch the question to something else? Because, I'll come back to it. But where the spite is usually portrayed is when one of the ladies-in-waiting gets married and how Elizabeth reacts to that. And the usual story is that Elizabeth is jealous of them.
Yeah.
As jealous of these women anyway, because they're younger than her for the most part and more beautiful than her, though I'm not sure if you look at some of the portraits, so that wasn't necessarily true.
Yeah.
But that's not the point. The point is that in a number of cases, Elizabeth banishes the women or refuses to allow the marriage to go ahead. And in every case, as far as I know, it's when the woman has gone behind her back. So the kind of people that we're interested in here is Bess Throckmorton, who possibly no one, maybe don't, married secretly Sir Walter Raleigh. And Sir Walter Raleigh was as much Elizabeth's servant as a royal courtier.
Yeah.
And someone, you know, she was playfully flirtatious with, I'm sure. And Bess Throckmorton was her lady-in-waiting. They never told her. And in fact, Elizabeth had said to, I had asked Robert Cecil, her minister, to ask Raleigh, is it true? You know, there are rumours going on about your relationship with Throckmorton. And Raleigh denied it. And in those circumstances, it's not spite that seems to be Elizabeth's reaction. It's a perfectly understandable sense of, again, betrayal. I mean, you could say that she's too sensitive to the notions of betrayal, but she had pretty good reason to be.
Yeah, and she's just been lied to as well in the denial.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it happens quite often with these ladies-in-waiting. Now, you could say Elizabeth, she could have made it easier for them to get married and whatever. But I think Elizabeth is someone who actually doesn't want a lot of change. If they're her ladies-in-waiting, she'd much rather they stayed her ladies-in-waiting. She's selfish.
Yes, yeah, we'll admit that, yeah. Okay, so you mentioned that we go back to the how she manages these rivalries and how she manages her court.
Yes, well, as far as the women are concerned, they're not allowed to bring politics, or told that they can't bring politics into the Privy Chamber. That's it. They're meant to be apolitical and entertaining, and I think that's one way, to some extent, that she's able to prevent her private space becoming a centre for harmful gossip and harmful rivalries, because they're not allowed to bring it in. When it comes to the male courtiers, that's a difficult one, actually. She makes, and I think it gets out of control in the 1590s in a way that it didn't in, say, the 1560s or 1570s. There were undoubted rivalries in the 1560s between, for example, the Earl of Sussex and the Earl of Leicester, and they're even threatening to bring swords to court. And what Elizabeth does there is simply, you can't do it. You've got to make peace. I mean, she just lays down her, herself as the role of mediator, not actually mediating between their quarrels, but saying they can't get out of hand. So I think what she does is draw the line. I think that's how she manages it. I don't think, and this is one thing I get angry about, this idea that she is using one divide and rule. She's using one courtier to give him sort of favor in order to get the other courtier to try and serve her better. I think that's not how politics works at that point. I think the court knows that they can only go so far in their rivalries. Yes, there can be banter, they can be offering rival tokens for Elizabeth's favor and affection, and which they do. And that somehow has a playful element. But when it starts getting into policy disagreements, or when it starts getting into perhaps bringing swords to court, then Elizabeth lays down the law and says, no, that's it. Can't do it.
It's an interesting point you raised there, because there are an awful lot of portrayals of Elizabeth where she's almost flirtatiously like dangling the marriage carrot in front of one and then another, and you know, managing European affairs by going, well, I can't be held responsible for them. I'm just a girl. I mean, hey, how much of that is actually in Elizabeth? Where does that come from?
Yeah, I think too much has been made about political life with a woman at the helm. Mm-hmm. And again, I think there's a degree of sexism here.
Yeah.
That somehow that she only can get her way by being dazzling or being flirtatious. I mean, I have used the word flirtatious myself, but that so many of her attributes are to do with her gender. Mm-hmm. And moving on to some other attributes, which is again moving a bit further from what you want to say, is that, for example, she can't make up her mind. She is someone who is hesitant and is someone who chops and changes her mind. Now, it seems to me that if she were a male king, they wouldn't say she was hesitant. They would say that she was circumspect or she was cautious. and that's the thing. I think underlying my anger is this sense of misogyny. Mm-hmm. And it's a misogyny that is absorbed by female historians as well, that these are the kind of characteristics of women.
Yeah.
And the language that's being used, it's a language that you very rarely hear applied to men. And that's where my anger lies, and the spitefulness and the meanness and the jealousy. These are just aspects of that wider issue.
So we mentioned that we have this portrayal of Elizabeth, jealous, spiteful rumour. This comes from kind of later historical sources, because I understand nobody's actually accusing her of this at the time. I don't think they dare.
One interesting thing, though, is that jealous means something different.
So really?
Jealous. Yes, in the 16th, and I think this is perhaps one reason why there's been a misunderstanding. Jealous means suspicious. So when they talk about Elizabeth being jealous, they don't actually mean she's jealous in the way that we mean it, a form of envy. They actually mean she's suspicious of whatever it is they're referring to.
Yes, because there's so many times where people are getting married behind her back. She's right to be suspicious. I mean, she's one of the monarchs that's had the most of assassination threats against her. You'd be suspicious of everything.
Exactly, yes. I mean, she's living on a knife's edge virtually the whole time.
So how have, you know, you and other modern historians kind of reevaluated the narrative of Elizabeth then, and what new perspectives have emerged from a more nuanced analysis of her reign?
Well, this older view, I think, this use, just recently I was irritated by a book, not enraged, but certainly irritated by a book, and I won't name the name, which actually again refer to her as spiteful. So I don't think it's gone out of the window with new historians. I think new historians of today, to my mind, have focused too much on her gender.
Yeah.
That really has been the new approach. And some of the work has been really great, and it has given us new perspectives on what it meant to be a female monarch. But I think it's been exaggerated. And I think it's created some misunderstandings, both of politics at the time and of Elizabeth. To my mind, she is behaving more like a king than a woman.
Well put. Well put. So, in your opinion, then, to round off, what factors have contributed to the persistence of this myth and this idea? You mentioned there that, you know, historians are just as much to blame. How can a historian work to challenge this outdated and inaccurate portrayal, then, of who is, and I'm not a fan of Elizabeth I, I will, you know, Tracy Borman is on a quest to get me to like her, but she is one, you can't hide from the fact that she is an influential monarch.
Yeah. Well, I think Elizabeth has suffered from portrayals of her on film. Mm-hmm. So I think if you put Betty Davis in as Elizabeth I, you're bound to see a vindictive and spiteful woman. As she is portrayed, of course, mm-hmm. in the script, which is based on Lytton Strachey's writing about Elizabeth and Essex. Flora Robson, too, you know, the way that she portrayed Elizabeth, it was more dour than being sparky. But nevertheless, there were scenes where she is being shown as jealous of her women and upset about her looks getting older. And I think there is that continues to portray Elizabeth, because the films are keeping re-shown. Mm-hmm. And even Glinda Jackson's Elizabeth, which I thought was great, and it isn't shown so much now, is perpetuating this sense. Look at Kate Blanchett's, good grief.
Oh, Lord, I'd rather not. You know?
Well, I mean, it's the same story. You know, then you have the young Elizabeth, romantic, and then she decides she can't have a husband, so she's going to turn herself into the Virgin Mary. And what's more, she's going to be really nasty to Bess Throckmorton, because that's mm-hmm. who appears in that film. Because essentially she wants to hold on to the men and is jealous of the women. That sort of thing, really, actually, I can feel my anger rising. That film makes me very angry.
Well, I think a career as a screenwriter is your next step once you've explored the Stuarts. Thank you very much for that, Susan. Thank you. Do you feel better?
Yes, much better. Thank Wonderful. You for letting me get it off my chest.
You are welcome. Well, if you would like to know more about Sue's work, then you can and should get a copy of her latest book, From Tudor to Stuart, or any of the huge back catalogue of books that she has written. And you can follow her on Twitter at SueDora2689. 8513. We will have a link to that in the show notes, so you don't need to keep up. But once again, Susan, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you
and
very
enjoy
much.
The rest of the festival.
That was great fun.
Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. We've got more coming for you over the course of the festival. If you've not managed to make it this year, then the festival returns in autumn. The dates are 14th of September to the 22nd of September 2024. You can sign up to the festival mailing list at gloucesterhistoryfestival.co.uk and follow them on Twitter at GloucesterHistFest. And if you would like to support us, you can follow us on Twitter at History Rage, or you can subscribe to us on Patreon and support the show. For your £5 per month, we will give you early episodes, entry into all of our prize draws, unbiteable questions to future guests, and of course, the coveted History Rage mug. And you can subscribe at patreon.com/historyrage. But until our next special, from everybody here, stay angry. Bye-bye.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.